This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. The dope debate this week went to the Florida Supreme Court, or rather the debate over whether the public should actually be allowed to decide if marijuana can be used for medical purposes in the Sunshine State. Attorney General Pam Bondi's office argued this week that the Florida ballot measure on medicinal marijuana is misleading and could lead to more widespread weed use. Supreme Court Chief Justice echoed that concern in a question he posed to lawyers at the hearing.
If a student's just stressed over exams and they go in and see a doctor and they said, you know, I'm really stressed out. Well, I've got something I can help you with, and prescribes marijuana. Wouldn't that be included in this?
The Florida Supreme Court Chief Justice Ricky Polston this week during the hearing on whether Florida voters ought to be allowed to vote on a referendum for medical uses for marijuana. Should Floridians be able to even vote on the issue? Should it be decided by public referendum, by the high court, or by the state legislature? And more to the central question, should medical marijuana be legalized in the state of Florida? This is the Florida Roundup. Your input is welcome and, quite frankly, expected at 800-743-WLRN. Help us understand your thoughts on this issue, the dope debate, at 800-743-9576. Email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org, on Twitter at WLRN, and our web chat ongoing right now, hosted by our digital editor at WLRN.org. Greg Allen from National Public Radio along with us, Tim Padgett, our America's editor here at WLRN, and Derek Kim with News Service of Florida, all with us here on the Florida Roundup. First of all, here, Greg, tell us what this debate is really all about. Is it about medicinal use or about the public's voice in medicinal use of marijuana?
Yeah, I don't think we've gotten to the medicinal use debate yet. I mean, the debate now is whether it should be on the ballot. And of course, the Florida legislature does not has a history of opposing referendums brought forward by citizen action. They've fought many of these in the past. If it gets on the ballot, I think we do suspect it would pass. But they don't like to let things on the ballot that they don't bring through the legislature. So that's where we start. I'm not exactly sure where the opposition to it, to allowing the citizens to vote on it, comes from, but that's what's going on right now.
Derek Hammond, Tallahassee with the News Service of Florida. Tell us about the amendment itself that is the source of the friction.
Well, first, let's talk about why the legislature, another reason why the legislature might not want this on the ballot is because it would probably appeal to people who may not vote for Governor Scott. It would appeal to young people, people who might be a little more left-leaning. He's going to be on the ballot up for re-election. So that's another sort of motivator for people to, for the Republican-dominated legislature to not want this to go before voters in November. What the Supreme Court heard oral arguments, their decision isn't about whether people should, isn't on, you know, the merits of this constitutional proposed amendment. It's about whether it passes the requirements that it not be misleading. And so that, you know, the argument is that Attorney General Bondi's office was making is that it is misleading because it says that, you know, that doctors can prescribe it for debilitating illnesses. And as the clip that you played of the Chief Justice, Ricky Polston, was saying, well, you know, the doctor can really decide it, because it's not limited to just debilitating illnesses. The doctor, it also says, you know, or whatever the doctor decides can be debilitating.
Well, it says debilitating diseases as determined by a licensed Florida physician. But to that question, Dara, I mean, the question the Supreme Court needs to answer is whether or not that's misleading. I mean, that seems relatively straightforward. Let's put aside the issue about politics here. The phrase debilitating diseases determined by a licensed Florida physician seems pretty clear.
Well, the argument by the Attorney General's office is that it's not clear, that a doctor has too much leeway, as the justice was asking. You know, does it mean if you have anxiety, can a doctor decide that that's a debilitating illness? You know, on the other side, John Mills, who wrote the amendment and is a former House Speaker and a constitutional scholar, teaches at the University of Florida, he argued that no, it's not. It's very clear that, you know, that a doctor would have to make a decision that it's a debilitating. If it's debilitating, it's debilitating. It can't be for something like a hangnail or a backache.
Yeah, absolutely. That's Derek Kim with the News Service of Florida. Tim Padgett, we've seen this dope debate extend throughout this hemisphere. Of that, there's no question. I mean, clearly Colorado and California are the domestic examples of medical marijuana. In the case of Colorado now, recreational use of certain amounts has been okayed, but this really is beginning to be a hemispheric debate now.
Oh yeah, and I think it's very apt that this week, the same week that Attorney General Bondi is arguing this, we had the President of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, visit Miami, and that's significant because Santos last year became the first active Latin American head of state, really, to tell the United States, look, the drug war is not working. We're the ones down here who suffer the brunt of the bloodshed, and it's time for the United States to start reconsidering how you're fighting this war. And one way you could do that is start thinking about legalizing at least benign drugs like, or more benign drugs like marijuana. And increasingly, we're seeing Latin American heads of state step up and make that same argument. And, you know, this really irritates the Obama administration. But I think you're seeing growing sentiment in the United States for this sort of thing, because we're wasting billions of dollars every year chasing dime bags of weed. More than half of U.S. drug arrests in this country involve pot. And so we're putting an incredible number of people behind bars for what many people say really should be a misdemeanor.
A poll last month from Quinnipiac finding that 82% of Floridians support allowing adults to use marijuana for medical reasons with a doctor's prescription. This is at the heart of the debate that we had this week at the Florida Supreme Court, debating whether or not the public ought to be able to vote on a referendum for medicinal marijuana use. Dr. Christopher Larish is a psychiatrist specializing in addiction. He's against the legalization of marijuana, at least in his estimation, until scientists are able to figure out exactly what's in it.
Marijuana is a very complex compound. If I prescribe somebody Xanax, that's one molecule that I write on that prescription. If I give somebody marijuana, that's a compound of over 400 molecules. And we're still trying to figure out what marijuana is.
Dr. Christopher Larish making his comments at the Tower Forum discussion Thursday in Fort Lauderdale here in South Florida. Susan Goldstein is a former Florida state representative with a 21-year-old daughter with autism. She's in favor of legalizing medical marijuana, because in her estimation, it's another treatment that could potentially help her daughter and those like her with developmental disabilities.
A parent that has a child with a disability, especially one that you don't know what causes it and there's no cure for it, I mean, we've tried everything from every kind of therapy that's out there. And the one thing that you don't try, you think could have been that which could have helped her.
Some of the comments this week at the Tower Forum in Fort Lauderdale, the discussion over dope, medical dope in the state of Florida. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Natalie joins us from Coral Springs. Natalie, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Go ahead with your thoughts.
My personal opinion is that apparently the Chief Justice said that students would come in to doctors stating that they are anxiety over exams and therefore the doctors could prescribe them marijuana. But in turn, if marijuana, whether it is in the picture or not, you still get prescribed all kinds of drugs, whether it be Ambien or Prozac or whatever else drug is out there to attack these psychological or psychiatric situations. So it's really a matter of a social economical situation, taking the power away from the pharmaceuticals or in turn making the big bucks and giving it to the little guy who can literally grow it in the backyard.
Natalie from Coral Springs, interesting perspective, Greg Allen, to that point, you know, right? If the argument is over the definition that doctors are going to use for debilitating diseases, they already have a portfolio of medicine to prescribe.
And think about what we've been seeing in this state with pain clinics over the last few years. I mean, what the Chief Justice laid out, yes, that will happen. I mean, let's face it, we've seen this model in other states, and it's not a mystery what will happen with medical marijuana, is that, yes, it will make it more widely available. People will come in and find ways to get it.
I mean, under this rationale, Dara, should we have the same kind of Supreme Court arguments over any anxiety medicine or any kind of prescribed medicine? If the standard of debilitating diseases as determined by a licensed Florida physician is at the heart of the complaint, the natural extension is to debate every pharmaceutical possibility.
Well, those are things that are already legal, though, so it really isn't. And I mean, I think it's you're talking about two separate things. One of the other problems that was raised about the amendment yesterday was whether it was again misleading, because it said that it would not have any impact on federal laws that make marijuana illegal.
That's right.
And so there was a question. Some of the justices were questioning whether that was misleading, because it would not change the federal law, which still says that marijuana is illegal. So that's another question. To the point of raising pot in your backyard, the way that this amendment is crafted, people wouldn't be allowed to raise it themselves. It would only be where you would go to get your prescription filled. Those places would be the only ones that could manufacture it them. Also, there wouldn't be any, there's no provision for importing of it.
Right.
So there's no way under this, if it is allowed to get to the ballot and they get the signatures, that people at this point, you know, would be able to start, growing pot in
right.
their bathtubs.
The question is, should the State Department of Health register and regulate centers mm-hmm. that produce and distribute marijuana, not the guy in the backyard in Kendall right. or in Weston that's growing some perhaps on their window ledge, Tim?
Well, right. And coincidentally, the country of Uruguay down in South America is poised to legalize marijuana. I believe next month its Congress is going to legalize it. And coincidentally, it will have a lot of those same kind of parameters set about who can grow it, who can distribute it, and who can buy it. For example, if you and I go down to Uruguay after this is legalized, we won't be able to buy it. It'll mm-hmm. only be Uruguayans. And their argument is that, you know, we can regulate this, and it's worth regulating if we legalize it. It's worth legalizing because it will deprive criminal gangs, especially the drug cartels in Latin America, of a significant chunk of their revenues.
Yeah, it's the argument still is part social, and we're beginning because of the experiences that we're seeing internationally in Uruguay, likely, and some of the experiences that Colorado, Greg, is reporting back and California is reporting back. It's becoming certainly an economic argument as well. Mez joins us from Miramar here on the Florida Roundup. Mez, go ahead.
Yes, my comment is twofold. One, if we, the citizen, cannot go to the poll and decide what we want to be on the ballot, I think it defeats the democratic process. And two, looking at it from an economic standpoint, it will do us a lot of good if we're not chasing, you know, petty criminals trying to put them in jail, when we can regulate marijuana and, you know, use that money to do a lot of good, such as school and rehab clinics and all. We put a lot of people in jail for things that are very petty when it comes to marijuana. So from someone who never smoked, doesn't use drugs, I think we should decriminalize marijuana, period. Not just on a medical standpoint, but decriminalize it altogether.
Mez, thank you for your thoughts today on the Florida Roundup from Miramar. Greg, what I've been interested in is we haven't seen a lot of the other domestic experiences of states that are further along in this experiment, this economic experiment and social experiment with legalizing medicinal marijuana, dispensing marijuana, or even recreational use marijuana. Colorado and California enter into this Florida debate.
Right. And think about it. I mean, Florida is so far away geographically and culturally from those two areas. It would be a new experience here, but I think there'll be a lot to learn there. The one point from our caller I think is true is what's unfortunate about this is that the real debate is not going forward. They're arguing about whether this is misleading when we know what's really going on is people want to actually debate the actual topic. Let's put it out to the voters. Let the voters decide.
We have a comment from our Facebook page from Margaret writing, "I tuned out the minute you introduced the show referring to marijuana as dope. I don't know whether you are trying to be cute. Anyone who's had a family member or friend going through chemotherapy and radiation racked by pain and nausea will understand how important marijuana is." She continues on our Facebook page, "My late husband got more pain and nausea relief from pot, quote pot, than any other medications he was getting. Please don't trivialize a serious discussion with your cavalier attitude. Tim, this does get down to the language here, and the language is really what's key, Tim and Dara, when it comes to this referendum about whether or not it is clear in the eyes of the Florida Supreme Court that Floridians will be able to understand what the issue is. Tim?
This is about a lot more than semantics. This is about a fear that if you legalize medical marijuana, you could have a snowball effect or a domino effect, use whatever metaphor you want to. But there are a lot of conservatives in Florida, and they run politics here right now, who fear that if you legalize medical marijuana, that's just going to lead to the public then wanting to legalize marijuana, period.
Outright,
like Washington and Colorado.
Right.
And they would rather sort of cut that off at the pass, I think, than see that process get underway.
Dara, from your perspective, is this an end run around the state legislature, and what are the options the Supreme Court has in front of it?
Well, of course, all of these citizens' initiatives are end runs around the legislature, so there's no question about that. But I think that it is the debate that happened before the Supreme Court yesterday is really about the semantics. The Supreme Court, whatever they decide, hopefully, they're the highest court in the state, and their analysis of this amendment is very limited. They're not going to make a decision based on whether they think it's a good idea for doctors, whether it's a good idea for voters to decide whether doctors should be able to prescribe pot or not. Their task is to decide whether this meets the constitutional restrictions on what a ballot amendment can say. So, I mean, I think that's an important distinction to make. We can all be talking about the politics of this, and I agree with, the conservatives are afraid that it's a slippery slope but what is before the Supreme Court, which is very important, and which they seemed very skeptical of this yesterday too.
But were they skeptical on the semantic point, or were they skeptical on the overall idea of the slippery slope? That's I think that's the concern for many people, is that they worry that the justices might be swayed by politics.
Well, based on their discussion, they're concerned about the semantics of it. I mean, I can't say that our justices are using politics to analyze this amendment, but they were saying that you use a phrase that says there's
debilitating diseases as determined by a licensed Florida physician.
Right. And what does that mean?
Yep, exactly. Keeping it to the narrow focus that is usually the case when it comes to these kinds of court arguments. David joins the Florida Roundup from Fort Lauderdale. David, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say that I have a personal interest in this. Both my wife used it to treat her cancer, and I used it to treat chronic arthritic pain in my hips and back and neck from being a dwarf. And so I'm passionately for the legalization of medical marijuana. But I also wanted to say that there have been studies done that have shown that teenage non-medical use of marijuana is not any worse in medical marijuana states than it is in non-medical marijuana states. And that is the only concern that I can think of that people should be worried about, and that is not proven to be an issue. Thank you very much.
David in Fort Lauderdale joining the discussion here about the potential effort to put a referendum on the Florida ballot to allow Floridians to vote on the medicinal use of marijuana. Juan joins us from Hollywood. Welcome to the Florida Roundup, Juan.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to mention that I'm definitely for this, and I think the people should decide it. And one of my concerns is, why do we have 20 states that already have it legal for our veterans to use, and the rest of the states do not, when they're coming back with PTSD and various injuries that potentially could be cured or helped by medical marijuana?
Greg, Tim, Dara, anybody familiar with the claim that Juan has, 20 states allow it for the treatment of PTSD?
I am not, no.
No, there are 20 states that have authorized, 20 states and the District of Columbia that have legalized medical marijuana. I don't know whether they're...
Not solely for PTSD, but
no,
for medical uses.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
But it mitigates pain, so...
For PTSD and for other issues, yeah.
Yeah, but they come back with various issues of pain relation that marijuana can help with, and it's much less dangerous than Oxy and all the other pain meds that are out there.
And that was a point that Greg, made earlier. Juan joining us from Hollywood here on the Florida Roundup, talking about the Supreme Court argument that was heard this week in Florida regarding a public referendum on the legalization of medicinal use of marijuana. Still to come here on the Florida Roundup, Miami-Dade County votes to return 5% to workers' paychecks, money the workers had been spending on their own health insurance. So if you work for the county, if you're a county taxpayer, should the money go back, even if it leads to layoffs or other budget trouble? This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. We're less than a year away from Election Day, and Governor Rick Scott's administration continues making voting procedures an issue. The administration declared the only method to turn in absentee ballots was the county supervisor of elections office. We're joined on the Florida Roundup by Derek Kim with News Service of Florida, with us from Tallahassee, Greg Allen from National Public Radio, with us in studio here in Miami. Dara, what's this issue that continues coming up, and specifically the most recent action by the Scott administration to require absentee ballots only be turned in at the supervisor's office?
Right. It came right before the Pinellas County supervisor was going to send out absentee ballots in the special election in Congressional District 13 to replace the late Bill Young. And she apparently uses, and many of the supervisors use, these drop-off boxes at places like early voting sites. And the Secretary of State sent out a directive saying you can't use them anymore. And so it created a huge, you know, she actually responded to him and said, you know what, I'm not going to listen to you. I'm going to do it anyway. He backed off after talking to her and sent her a note and said, well, it looks like you've got security provisions in you that I was unaware of, and so you can go ahead and do it. But it's another case of the Scott administration sort of meddling into the supervisors, and and Senator Bill Nelson has asked the Department of Justice to look into it.
Greg, I mean, this dates back to the U.S. Supreme Court ruling from not that long ago regarding the 1964 Voting Rights Act and some practices in Florida.
Right. Well, that they changed the federal law so that on that you don't have to get preclearance. But in this case, what we're seeing is this once again, this conflict between a political appointee. The Secretary of State in many states is elected by the people,
right,
and is answerable to the people. In this state, the Secretary of State is answerable to one person, that's the governor. And that in this case, it's Ken Detzner is answerable to Rick Scott. So clearly this is an action by Rick Scott. Every supervisor of election is, with a few exceptions here in Miami-Dade, they're appointed by the county.
That's the only one, yeah.
But everywhere else, they're elected. So they are answerable to the people. So they actually think that that's who they should be listening to. But you've got this tug of war that's been going on between the governor's office and with the supervisor elections. And I would all but guarantee we're going to see this probably heat up between now and next year when the governor's race happens.
Yeah, Dara, any guesses on where the next place this is going to heat up? I mean, it showed up in the Gulf Coast in the past 10 days because of a special election. Any guesses as to where the next place the Scott administration may push against voting procedures?
You know, I don't know. The only other thing I can think of right offhand is this push for this non-citizen purge, right? So they abandoned that effort last year. They have now got the access to the SAVE database, the Department of Homeland Security database. The supervisors have not signed on to this yet. And, you know, Governor Scott, I think, really wants to push forward with this non-citizen purge, even though there's really no evidence showing that there's all this voter fraud out there. The supervisors didn't like it. They got the brunt of the, you know, negative reactions from the voters. I've spoken to many of them who just don't want to have to do this again. And that's kind of in limbo. So I don't know whether they're going to really push them to do this non-citizen purge mm-hmm. or not, but that would be the only thing that I'm aware of right now. But I mean, this came out of nowhere. So
the Gulf Coast scenario in the last 10 days.
Right.
Right.
And at one point I asked Ken Dessner, the Secretary of State, when he was here for a meeting about this, about these charges that he's politicized. And he said, I answer to the people. And, you know, basically denied any charge that has anything to do with politics at all. And I think that many of us who follow it think this is all about politics.
Well, politics is certainly on the thoughts of Charlie Crist supporters. Also, dollars are on the minds of Governor Crist supporters, raising more than $2 million in the month of November. Normally, reporting on all of this is kind of just an indication, Dara, of the horse race. But here we are 11 months out from an election. Give us the context in which this $2 million was raised.
Sure. Well, this is his first fundraising effort, you know, right out of the gate after he's been talking for almost a year, hinting about running for governor. So normally this would just be sort of a dollars and cents kind of a story. But this is the first month of his fundraising. Coming out of the gate, he's got a little over $2 million in his campaign committee. We don't know how much he will have collected, I'm sorry, in his committee, the Charlie Crist for Florida committee. Mm-hmm. Those committees, just to refresh people's memory, can take unlimited amount of money. The regular campaign for what we call hard money can take, their contributions are capped at $3,000. So we've heard John Morgan, Charlie's, the governor's boss, hint that we might see as much as that in the campaign account. So possibly somewhere $3-4 million in his first month. That's a lot of money for a non-incumbent, someone who has not been in office for a little while. But let's look at what Governor Scott's Let's Get to Work committee collected. More than $5.8 million in November.
It's going to be off to the races already with close to $10 million raised just between those two candidates here. And we're still 11 months out before voters go to the polls. We are talking about state politics and the state economy. Join the conversation at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. On Twitter, use the call sign at WLRN or online with our web chat at WLRN.org. Job creation in the economy has been Governor Scott biggest priority during his time in office. That's what got him to the governor's office, after all. Nationally, we learned today the unemployment rate fell to 7% in November. Pretty good jobs report we had for the nation. 203,000 jobs added throughout the United States. The most recent Florida unemployment rate fell to 6.7%. Again, pretty good indicator of employment here in the Sunshine State. But incomes, though, remain stagnant. And this is something I spoke with Dennis Lockhart. He's the CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, whose region includes Florida.
The overall driver of that is broad-based demand in an economy that is roughly two-thirds driven by the consumer.
You mean demand for workers?
I mean business demand that then turns into the demand for workers.
And that kind of cycle hasn't really clicked overall to translate, to Greg, into higher incomes for the state of Florida. But yet that has also not become a political issue, at least not yet.
No, and you know, it's kind of what we see on the national level. People will talk about it, but it's not one that we've actually seen mobilize people at the polls. You know, and the Florida's problem, as you all know, is that we have so many people in the service economy here, I mean, including government positions. And those are good paying service positions compared to some. But you know, as I mentioned earlier, the governor's here in town today out at the port again, because that's something that's concrete that actually can produce good paying jobs.
Yep.
We'll see if it actually does with the widening of the Panama Canal, but there's not that many of those kind of jobs around in Florida.
Well, you mentioned the port and trade. Brazil, of course, is a key part of that for South Florida. A lot of those good paying trade jobs are associated to the trade that we do with Brazil. The Brazilian economy has hit a soft patch, and I was speaking with the Federal Reserve President Lockhart about that, and he said they're watching Brazil very, very closely, especially in the context of what it means for job growth and income growth for South Florida. Well, following the national discussion about minimum and livable wages and government assistance on jobs and income, WLRN wants to know what you think is enough to live on in South Florida. How much is enough? Tell us at WLRN.org. Tweet us with the hashtag, how much is enough? Miami-Dade County workers may see a little bit more in their paychecks, 5% returned to their paychecks. The county commission this week okayed returning that money, which workers had been spending for a portion from their health insurance. It was a tense and emotional hearing Thursday, 13 hours long, with the commissioners voting finally 8-3 to end the deductions and balance the budget by dipping into various other departments. The county mayor, Carlos Jimenez, said giving back the 5% would be a significant setback to the county's fragile recovery. How much of a setback? That's what Commissioner Esteban Bobo wondered.
If it's the wish of this commission to restore the 5%, are we looking at layoffs as a way to be able to make our budget whole?
In all probability, yes.
Patty Massey covers county politics for the Miami Herald, and she joins us now. Patty, what happened at the hearing? What's the next step?
Well, now Mayor Jimenez must decide whether he wants to veto this decision. It's likely that he will. It's also likely that the commission could get together a supermajority to override his veto. There were two commissioners absent yesterday. One of them, Commissioner Jose Pepe Diaz, has indicated that he wants to help the unions. So that would be the ninth and decisive vote if everybody else stays the same. But, you know, that could all change, which is why the mayor sometimes vetoes items just to see if people maybe change their minds from one vote to the next.
And to be clear, we're not talking about a pay raise, of 5%. It is returning 5% that the workers had taken as part of a budgetary process a few years ago to contribute to their own health insurance premiums.
Well, that was actually a semantic discussion that took a bit of time yesterday, because the mayor considers it a raise. Some commissioners were like, well, no, we're just returning them the pay that they give up when times were tough.
Yeah, you could always just actually have them contribute and then give them 5%, and then everybody would be happy, right? But that's not going to happen either.
We had the same little debate when it came to the Social Security contribution on the national scale that was cut by 2% and then returned. Republicans called that a tax increase, and of course the supporters said, no, we're just resorting back to what the tax rate had been.
Right, but on this debate here, you know, there politically speaking, there is nothing to be gained by taking Jimenez's position here.
Patty, do you agree with that? If the mayor vetoes this, is there nothing politically to be gained?
Well, I think it will depend on what cuts come as a result, because politically it's unpopular, certainly in some districts represented by county commissioners, to raise taxes. But if that is the option that comes because the budget hole is too big to fill next year, then commissioners would have to vote on a higher tax rate a month before they get reelected, at least six of them. So, you know, the problem I hear, I think, is usually short-term versus long-term. And at least recently, the commission has made more votes, I think, looking at the short-term rather than the long-term.
Haven't we seen this played out before a little bit, Greg?
Exactly. And you could imagine the mayor very much presenting a budget that would include that.
I don't think we have to imagine. I think we just have to wait for it.
Yes, exactly. And so
he has said he's not planning on raising the tax rate. So
just wait for the budget cuts to be made public.
Yeah, I mean, he was talking about layoffs, like you noted, and then the question will come: well, how many layoffs, if any, are acceptable to commissioners, half of them who face re-election next year?
Right, or they'll start closing libraries, right? That'll be the
Derek Kim from the News Service of Florida in Tallahassee. A great point, because, you know, what was it, 6-8 months ago, it was closing libraries, laying off libraries, and Patty.
Just three months ago.
All right.
And yes, that is still a problem. They still have a hole in the budget for the fire rescue district and for the libraries, and this is just creating a bigger hole for them next year.
And the options are layoffs, budget cuts, or tax increases.
Pretty much.
They found money for the libraries, right?
They tapped the reserve.
That rainy day fund is no longer
right.
a fund.
I might point out here, I mean, for someone who doesn't work for the county, you know, I mean, it's not unusual at all for people to contribute their own money to. I mean, that's very typical nowadays.
I believe nobody talking on the radio station at this moment works for the county. So
right.
I think you're absolutely right.
But most people in the private sector actually contribute toward their health care. That would seem to be appropriate. Now, the question is, to make this cut permanent is what we're talking about here also.
Well, and Patty, the other argument is, well, the salaries aren't commiserate to what's happening in the private industry. But when I interviewed Mayor Jimenez about a number of different things just a few months ago, Patty, he had mentioned in his thoughts, listen, there's a lot of county employees, I think his word was overpaid.
he has maintained that position. I think it's important to clarify that this was a contribution towards the cost of group health care. It was really kind of an accounting solution to prevent an across-the-board wage cut for all workers. The 5% did not mean that individual workers were paying that towards their individual health care premiums. The county has always covered the premiums for the workers themselves, and that has not changed at any point. Workers pay their copays and their prescriptions, and then they pay for their dependents. But this was, because it's an accounting thing, it gets into the weeds of the budget process. The mayor was pointing out yesterday that some people, you know, make good money in the county, and there were both sides of that at the hearing. There was people who made, you know, $65,000-$70,000, and then there were people who make just under $20,000. So there's a broad range there.
Patty Mazzei covering county politics in Miami-Dade County for the Miami Herald, joining us here on the Florida Roundup. This discussion wants to hear from you. How much is enough? We want to know what you think enough money is to live on in South Florida. A new project we're partaking here and undergoing at WLRN.org. Let us know or send us a tweet using the handle at WLRN with the hashtag #HowMuchIsEnough. This is the Florida Roundup. We've got plenty more to come. The art party hits full swing in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks for listening.
My name is Miranda Child, and I live in Hallandale Beach. My earliest memory is of me singing, I enjoyed being a girl, from Flower Drum Song, into a long mirror. Oddly enough, I did become a singer and dancer on Broadway.
My name is Greg Pearson. I live in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Well, the first creative thing that I can remember doing is a self-portrait of myself that I did back in 2002 using oil paintings. I needed a cover for a book that I had written.
I'm Tom Collins. I'm director of the Perez Art Museum, Miami. At some point in my very early childhood, I realized that grass seed could grow on a wet sponge. And so my parents discovered this little lawn somewhere in the house when I was 3-4 years old.
We celebrate arts this time of year. We celebrate the art commerce throughout the year here in South Florida, but particularly during Art Week. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Greg Allen with National Public Radio is still with us. Alicia Zuckerman, editorial editor here at WLRN, joins us as well. Several things going on during this Arts Week here. There's a real culmination of things. The 12th year of Art Basel, which we'll talk about in a moment, but of course it is on the front porch of Biscayne Bay, where this multi-million-dollar Perez Art Museum Miami opened its doors, Greg, for the first time, and not without a little bit of controversy. But Alicia, you were there for that reception as well. Generally, what's the environment? I mean, very, very excited. The community is
very excited, and I have to say, like, the physical environment, like the building, is absolutely beautiful. You know, I came down here 7 years ago after living in New York City for about 7 or 8 years and growing up really close to the city and constantly going into the museums there. And, you know, I just felt like this sense of pride, which was interesting. I guess that's, you know, taking ownership of this place. And that's what I think this building is evoking in people, is for the locals, you know, a sense of pride. The building is so spectacular. It's clear that they're really trying to push the visual arts in Miami forward with this building. It's a huge statement.
Yeah, it's a huge statement. It is a significant point of, I think, regional pride, local pride, Greg. But as things are here in Florida, there's also a good chunk of controversy around it.
Well, I think the controversy by now has pretty much dissipated, except for those people like myself who like to keep digging into things and bringing it up. But, you know, I mean, of course, we have, it's Perez Art Museum Miami, and that created some controversy because it was named for George Perez, the great developer who's done so much to reshape the city already. And then you have this sense that he's going to, you know, that he's put his name is now on this iconic building that I think will become one of the, when we hate to do sports events here, they're going to show this.
The landscaping's not even done, and we're referring to it as an iconic building.
I think it really will be, because this is an area area that's going to be, this museum park area is going to be, I think, a center place, a centerpiece of activity in Florida. And as they continue along the waterfront there, it's going to be very important. And George Perez's name is right there out front.
And he addressed this controversy head on when I spoke to him just a couple of weeks ago before the art museum opening.
I think maybe the name Perez doesn't sound, you know, as familiar, you know, with all these other names. You know, you have to remember this is the first Hispanic name in a major institution in this country.
And that is a significant point of pride for him personally. And Alicia, to your point, probably in the years ahead, a point of pride for the community.
Definitely. I was thinking about the name, and if you think about it, some of the great museums around the world are not named after their cities, but named after names. The Guggenheim,
the Tate
in New York, the Tate, the Walker in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is not like breaking new ground.
And I think the issue with the name is, all this will pass, you know, in time. But the issue, if the practical point now is that they're working to build a permanent collection. You know, this Miami's a young city. Right. The old museum didn't really have much of one. George Perez has contributed a lot of his contribution was in art. But as you well know, we have nearly a dozen world-class private collections here. And by putting the name of someone on there who is not really considered to be one of the top flight collectors in Miami, putting his name on there, you've basically sent a message to the other collectors in town. Now, do you want to have your art in the Perez Art Museum? Now, you know, over time that will dissipate and then we'll get past that. But that's a practical problem that I think that the museum will and they'll have to deal with.
And another practical problem that I don't know whether it's actually a problem, but certainly some of the criticism that I've been hearing is that the building itself is better than the collection. there were press from all over at the opening that I went to, and that was, you know, some of what people were asking was related to that question. And so whether that's true or not, you know, I'm not sure. But at this point, it probably is. I mean, the museum just opened. The building is so amazing. But think about it, like you're a collector and you have the option of giving your artwork if you want to do that or lending your artwork to any place in the country. And do you want to lend it to a museum that is frankly not very interesting to look at, not a great building, not much of a draw the way the old Miami Art Museum was, as much as I do love that plaza near Government Center? Or do you want to put it in this place? It's almost like thinking of it as this fantastic frame, and that you know is going to really draw more visitors.
And world-class iconic museums do become works of art themselves. The buildings themselves speak to not only the purpose of the collections and the reflections that they provide with the works of art or works of science that they're displaying, but the buildings themselves are expressions of that. And we're seeing that here in South Florida with the Perez Art Museum Miami, with the new Frost Science Museum that's being built as part of the museum campus. But we're seeing it even, Alicia, in parking garages on Miami Beach, right?
1111, yeah, 1111 Lincoln Road.
As it was said to me,
same architect, right?
It was said to me this week at a event at FIU that I was participating in, only in Miami would a parking garage become iconic for its architecture.
And do you know that that parking garage has an events planner? They have weddings at that parking garage.
I actually expected more when I went there. I thought, after hearing so much about it, it's still a parking garage.
It's a parking garage. That's right. Its form maybe follows the function ultimately.
I love it.
But it gets beyond obviously just the particulars of a parking garage architect. I mean, Miami has been known for shallow roots of culture, for shallow roots of architecture design. I mean, you can still essentially pick out the decades of buildings as you drive up and down Biscayne or drive up and down Federal or drive up and down Collins. But perhaps the world's view of South Florida's seriousness is beginning to reflect a little bit of the kinds of cultural economic investments, Alicia, that we've seen really come to fruition this week.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think just today or earlier this week, there was a report from the Commerce Department saying that arts and culture in 2011, which I guess was the most recent data available, arts and culture accounted for more than $500 billion, that's with a T, $500 billion in economic impact. And what really surprised me about that was that was a higher number than the travel and tourism industry. Of course, here in South Florida, they're inextricably linked.
I think
that people are beginning to realize that. So we have, you know, this community that is starting to, or that has already for decades, appreciated art for art's sake, art as the end itself, as opposed to a means to an end, but also this sort of, you know, larger community of people who understand this is a real economic driver. It's really important. We better care about the arts because we need to serve, because it brings us money.
Yeah, Greg, I mean, nationally, I think it's fair to say, even from Miami, that a lot of the country can look toward Miami, specifically South Florida generally, as a creative place, but it's usually tinged in hues of orange and turquoise.
Right. If you think about what a change Miami's gone through
Aqua
the last,
blue, excuse
last
me.
Decade plus, you know, the for one of the most concerned, I thought an interesting thing is, while there's all this talk about whether we can get the Super Bowl ever again, it's kind of a big yawn about that. People could almost not care. But when there was discussion this week that Art Basel could move when they're redoing to another city for when they're redoing the convention center, that was a very large source of concern. I think we'd be much more concerned about Art Basel perhaps removing for a year or two. So that I would hope that's not going to happen.
Well, in fact, the Art Basel CEO did tell Doug Hanks of the Miami Herald that while they hadn't had any discussion with a specific city about the potential of moving, as the Miami Beach Convention Center debate will likely continue for the next year or so.
Right. And as you were saying earlier, you know, this idea that we're kind of like Southern California, a place that's a wonderful place. We've always seemed to be a little bit insecure about our cultural roots. And now it's very clear that Miami has a very strong claim to being an international arts destination. And it's because of the people who live here, who are dedicated to art. And it's the people who've done it, you know?
Greg, yeah, that's exactly right, yeah.
Alicia Zuckerman with WLRN, Greg Allen with National Public Radio. I'm Tom Hudson here on the Florida Roundup. This week also, we must mention the passing of Nelson Mandela. And with his passing late yesterday, Miami was forced to remember a racially divisive issue for the community, often referred to as the Mandela snub. Elected leaders decided not to welcome the political activist to Miami in 1990 because of his comments that he made in the week prior to visiting South Florida supporting Cuba's Fidel Castro. The Miami Herald's Karen Runlett grew up in Miami and was beginning her career as a journalist back in the summer of 1990. This is how she remembers it.
The summer of 1990, I was home working part-time as a production assistant at a Miami television station. I made aspiring journalist money, $6 an hour. At my Washington, D.C. college, Georgetown University, a multiracial group of students had staged sit-ins calling for the school to divest from South Africa. I remember campus-wide reverse apartheid protest days. We were learning about modern-day systemic racial segregation. But in 1990, Nelson Mandela, who'd spent 27 years as a political prisoner, was released. The world applauded, cheered, and cried. The city of Miami, on the other hand, looked away dismissively, with elected leaders, five Cuban-American mayors in all, formally condemning Mandela for comments he made in support of Fidel Castro. My jaw dropped to the floor. I couldn't believe it. Individual citizens had every right to protest Mandela's comments, but the city of Miami's mayor putting the pain and politics of a single constituency ahead of what should have been the city's worldview? It felt like an insult. The local Black community fought back with dollars, not riots. Attorney H.T. Smith crafted a savvy 3-year economic boycott. There was an extra brand of resentment that came with this issue for Miami's Black community. African Americans had waged the war for civil rights that local immigrants were and now are benefiting from. I hope that fact never gets lost in translation again as we mature into a more united community, one where Miami is home to those who arrived yesterday and to those who arrived generations ago.
Karen Runlett from the Miami Herald remembering Nelson Mandela and the Mandela snub here in Miami as we remember the passing of the global politician from South Africa this week. That is the Florida Roundup for December 6th, 2013. If you missed the program, you can listen to it again tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. It'll be on the website later on this afternoon at WLRN.org. The program is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our executive producer is Peter Meritz, and our technical supervisor, Paul Leary. Stay tuned. South Florida Arts Beat is next. And Monday morning at 9, the Sunshine Economy, Beyond Basel. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.